Sit back, relax, and raise a glass, for spirits coming from the past. Sip on salt while your skin crawls with your pre-haunting wolf having a ball. Trope was all at Washington Pool, with guests and spirits in your favorite pools. Gather the others, no hesitating. The moment's approaching, it's now time to sing. Haunts and hearts, hearts and hearts, crack open the can and fill to the top. Haunts and hearts, haunts and hearts, this is your podcast and it's the Haunts and Hearts.
No matter where you're joining us from, welcome back to our realm. This is the Haunts and Hops podcast. We cover all things paranormal while going all out on delicious, scrumptious, tremendous craft beer from all over the country. Thanks to our sponsor, Tavor. Follow us on all social media platforms at Haunts and Hops. Johnny LaQuasta here with you at Jay Quasto. Who the hell's making that noise? Anyways, she is a veteran paranormal investigator, former team member on Ghost Hunters on A&E, a wealth of knowledge. And she's also legendary with her orange hair and wearing a Ric Flair cutoff t-shirt that was bought on Hollywood Boulevard, probably for $2.99. Find her at Ashley Trobe. Fight her on social media. She's Ashley Trobe.
Yo, it probably was $2.99. My fucking producer bought it for me. Well, he didn't buy it for me. He bought it for him and then was just like, I don't like this anymore. Do you want it? I was like, yeah, absolutely. So it's now I have this shirt.
It's a golden t-shirt. It's gold. Are you kidding me? It's Ric Flair. Come on now.
I love it.
I have a better t-shirt, but it's under my sweatshirt.
Pull up your sweatshirt.
It's a Skeletor Lucha Libre shirt versus He-Man.
Oh my God. I have to say, yes, I agree. Yes.
I win.
Now, please tell me. Well, okay. Let me introduce you first. She is certified in paranormal investigation and cryptozoology, a lifelong connection to the paranormal. Her one-woman show, 50 Shades of Mixed, is going to hit back the world real soon, and she's going to tell us about her t-shirt, A True Triple Threat. She's Anastasia Washington.
Hello, you guys.
Never heard of her.
Me either. She changes her name, you know, a couple times in her life, so who knows. my shirt's pretty cool. It's a Lucha Libre shirt with Skeletor versus He-Man, and we all know who would win.
Well,
me.
Yes.
Now, my boyfriend would win.
How did you get that t-shirt?
How did I get that t-shirt? At a convention.
Okay.
It's no fancy. There's no fancy thing. I saw a Skeletor doll, which is in the other room, and I ran towards the Skeletor doll, and then they're like, "And we have t-shirts." And I said, "Take all of my money. I was broke by the end of the con."
I am.
Well, speaking of taking people's money and things for sale, our special guest, so excited to have him on. He's a filmmaker with a strong affinity for the horror and sci-fi genre, and he just released his new book titled Bigfoot Does Not Exist, An Introduction to the Fundamental Principles of Statistics, Science, and Logic. Find him on all social media platforms at Michael J. Epstein, because he is Michael J. Epstein. Welcome to Haunts and Hops.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah,
and he is here to take our money,
and he loves Skeletor and Ric Flair, so it's all good.
As a matter of fact, they're both in your book, ironically.
I'm the next version will have Skeletor and Ric Flair. It'll be mostly about Skeletor and Ric Flair.
Yeah,
thank you, yeah. Thank you.
I feel like it was an oversight, and I appreciate you still considering talking to me about the book, despite the fact that I made that oversight.
It's like you use a scientific method to figure out who would win in a fight, Skeletor versus Ric Flair.
Absolutely, and I think we all know the answer.
Ric Flair.
Yeah, Ric Flair.
Shut up, Anastasia. We were friends for too long to do that.
I will say, of course, Anastasia loves Skeletor. Like
I've told you guys this, right? Since I was a kid, I told people I'm not going to marry you. I'm going to marry Skeletor or the Crypt Keeper or Wolverine.
Okay, so
right.
Well, love is blind, so that's a good thing.
These are all amazing choices for men. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
I'm just throwing it out there. Like, look at well, this
I mean, at the very least, Crypt Keeper has jaundice. There's no question.
But he's a homeowner and he has a sense of humor.
I'm when a you... homo and have a sense of humor.
And when you look like Crypt Keeper, you better have a sense of humor. Jesus.
We can moisturize that.
I would say Skeletor is also a homeowner and has a sense of humor.
Exactly. Wow. That's my type.
Is Wolverine a homeowner? I'm not sure about that.
No, he's just very angsty and I haven't had that time.
Yeah. I'm just going to throw it out there as a gay person. I'm very offended that we're saying homeowner and not homo. And I'm just going to...
I'm so sorry.
I'm going to call bullshit on this. They have nothing to do with each other, Ashley.
If I said they're homo owners, that would be really bad.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I don't like that.
Yeah, see?
Ashley was trying to cancel us with something that made no sense.
No, it does make sense. I'm just saying, homeowner versus homo. Like, I just feel like I deserved better.
Well, no, you own who you are, and that's great. No one can buy that from you. But I can buy a condo if I had money.
You could.
Yeah.
It's okay. Yeah, gay people can't.
I mean, I would imagine they could buy whatever the hell they want. Anyways, let's give a shout out to our sponsor, Tavor. If you want to get a discount on your first crate of craft beer delivered right to your door, use the code HAUNTS10. That's HAUNTS10. Download the Tavor app and start building your crate immediately. We're going to give you $10 free. You're welcome. Speaking of which, let's get to the beers that we are enjoying tonight. Anastasia, I'm going to go to you first because you mentioned you have a very special one for us tonight.
I mean, I don't know if it's special. I smell something that I'm allergic to. So I guess that makes it kind of special. I am drinking Black Project from Backfire Brewery, where I'm trying to figure out where they're from.
Okay, and it's
Denver,
what kind of
Denver, mm-hmm. Colorado.
Yeah.
It is supposed to be a dry hopped sour with tangerine, but it really does smell like pineapple, so I'm a little scared right now. But let's just do it.
Go for it. It's a sour, already difficult. Secondly, she's taking a sip, and the face doesn't look that terrified, but will it start exploding?
It's a little tingly, so I think I'm allergic to it, but it's delicious.
All right. Well, how many ratings on the seizure scale would you give it?
On the seizure scale? I mean, on the expanded lip scale, it's probably, it's a 3 or 4, right now.
Okay. I love it. Ashley, how about you while you hug your cat?
Oh, my baby. This is Colin, for everybody that doesn't know. He's a fucking demon.
Yes, we know this.
He's the thing I've ever seen in my life, and he has a mustache. I am drinking, it's called The Real Dill. It's a michelada, and it is amazing. It's from Four Noses, which is in Colorado. And it's probably one of my most favorite canned micheladas that I've ever experienced.
And has dill in it?
It does. It's like drinking a michelada that's just straight pickle. And it's so good.
Weirdly enough, that does it for me.
Huh?
I said, weirdly enough, that does it for me. So
for me, it does. It's only 4.8%, but like, yo, this thing it's fucking fire. Like, it has the perfect amount of dill flavor. It's still a michelada, but it tastes really good. You know, there's only 2 michelada canned beverages that I've had where I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm into this. One of them is this one, and the other is the Thorn michelada. So I'm pleasantly surprised and very, very happy.
Good for you for even wanting to drink a michelada in the first place.
Want to drink micheladas. That's my entire life.
Okay.
It makes me miss Disneyland really bad.
Oh, same.
Why?
Because I drink micheladas.
Disneyland is delicious.
Yeah. I didn't know they had them at Disneyland. Okay, my bad.
Awesome. Oh, yes. I drink around Disneyland, and that is one of my drinks around Disneyland.
Right. Awesome. She pretends she's at Epcot and drinks around the world at Disneyland. It works.
Yeah.
No, Disneyland, not Disney World. It's different.
Yes, I know this. Michael, how about you? Are you a beer fan?
I'm a moderate beer fan, but I really have not had any beer since last March. So I feel like I have to listen closely about your sponsor and start ordering some. So that I,
if you want the best stuff,
access, my access has been somewhat limited in these times, but yeah.
Well, this one delivers right to your door, so it's perfect.
All right. Yeah, that is what I need.
Thanks, Tavor. I'm going to open up mine right now. There it is.
Wow.
Yes, and this brewery is Trophy Brewing Company out of Raleigh, North Carolina, which has an awesome comedy club I did one time, Good Nights. Great city. This is called I Can See My Helles From Here. It's a lager, 5.5%. Really solid artwork on the can. And it's basically a German-inspired lager because I believe the word Helles is a certain type of lager that I believe Germany is well known for. So I'm going to give it a go. And you know, it's a wonderfully smooth lager. I'm not really a lager person, but it's easy drinking and it's very good. So yeah, way to go, Trophy. Well, with that said, it's time for the Supernatural Scoop. Before we get into this story, so Michael, obviously your book title involves Bigfoot. Can we assume, obviously, you have a paranormal affinity?
I definitely, especially growing up, was very interested in especially cryptozoology and sort of aliens and all those kinds of things. And so that, you know, it's one of the reasons I wanted to play around with the some sort of tie into that in the discussion of how we structure, you know, thought and logic and all.
Okay, very good. Well, this one, it's more on the, you know, the spirit tip of things. So there's a hotel that has been reopened in Jefferson, Texas, called the Historic Jefferson Hotel. It was basically somewhat abandoned for a couple of years. A couple of owners, a married couple, bought the place, and they have reopened it now. They've trademarked, actually, the phrase, the world's most haunted hotel, which, you know, I think the Cecil Hotel may have.
I know. I was like, nah. Ramirez lived at
Cecil. Can I just say something really super stupid and shitty?
Go ahead.
It's very stupid and very shitty, and I'm so sorry for everybody that has to hear this today. But I was with my partner that I promise I was going to marry when we were like kids. We're okay. Like, yeah, we're going to get married when we're 40. And I was just like, we were at a hotel recently and I was just like, yeah, man, I don't want to get Cecil hoteled. I can't just fucking use the water at this hotel. We have to use bottled water. He's like, that's not a thing. And I was like, yeah, no, it is. I'm not going to get Cecil hoteled.
Okay.
Deal with that.
And are you that way at every hotel?
I'm that way in general. Dude, you know me. I'm a fucking asshole. Like, yeah, okay. Of course I am.
All right.
What am I like at Comic-Con? I'm terrible.
I mean, terrible is a subjective term.
Well, that's true.
Terribly fantastic. It's just terribly fantastic. I don't know. I feel like that's a big claim, the most haunted hotel, but... Why do they claim this? I want to hear why.
They're doing a great job at marketing. So there is a lot of history here. Built in 1851, it started off as a cotton warehouse. Then, of course, like everything built in the 1800s, it was a brothel at some point. Then it became a speakeasy, but it did operate as a hotel for about 100 years. So they reopened it, all 20 rooms in this. So it's a boutique hotel, 20 rooms. They all have a theme, especially room 14. It's called Dolls and Stuff. And the room is only 180 square feet. You are basically buried in dolls in this room.
Like that horror movie that scared me when I was a kid, and I had to rewatch it this year to make sure it wasn't as scary as it was when I was a kid. Dolls. I think it was called Dolls. Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah.
And so
no, we're not doing that. No.
Yeah.
It's scary. I like that.
Are they like old dolls? Or are they? I don't know.
Yeah, the owners have actually made a lot of purchases. They must have some kind of, you know, money to be doing because they're making purchases.
Buy a hotel.
Yeah, they're making like supposed haunted doll purchases and stuff like that. And they're, you know, they're specifically decorating each room. You can tell they put a lot of money into this place if you go to the website. And they've already, you know, had the Travel Channel show Hotel Paranormal out to visit, which I think that episode should be coming out at some point in the near future. They will be adding an escape room later this year. And you can go to historicjefferson.com if you want to check it out. But from what I understand, you know, they opened up obviously during a pandemic, but they feel good about it. And so far it's getting a decent amount of action and, you know, they're marketing it very well. Let's put it that way. And plus, I'll be honest, I don't want to stay at the Cecil. That place, 16 deaths, I think. And I know that it's supposedly reopening this year.
Ugh. And a serial killer lived there. You know, there's that too.
So. I'm not in. I love going for that kind of shit. And even me, I was just like, no, this is. This
I mean, I'd stay there.
But you okay? You? Well, Mike, how about you?
Oh, yeah, I'm not scared.
All right.
Of the I'm Cecil, in. Though?
I'm in.
Yeah, I'd stay. But also, this one, the Jefferson, they have really reasonable rooms. So I would totally stay there.
Yeah, I think the most expensive room is about $250 a night.
Yeah, hell yeah, I'm staying there. Like, it'll do it.
Now that I heard about this doll's room, I'm totally in.
Yeah, it looks very quaint. You know, 20 rooms, all different themes. I don't know where Jefferson, Texas is, but heck yeah. I mean, I'd want to stop by and check it out at least.
Wait, yeah. For the Cecil?
No, this is the Jefferson Hotel.
Oh, I was like, wait, the Cecil's in LA.
I the only thing is, you know, I have that cotton phobia. So like, and there was a cotton like manufacturer or something like that. So as long as like the haunting isn't like a cotton based haunting, I'm good.
Right. I would be surprised if there wasn't a room dedicated to it being a cotton warehouse at one point. But okay. Then again, that would also, with that logic, there'd also probably be a brothel room, which would be interesting.
I would stay in the brothel room. I'm not staying in the cotton room.
The brothel room, ironically, is the most expensive room. I don't know.
Anastasia, don't do that.
I'm going to do it.
But historicjefferson.com, definitely a good internet search. It's fun to look at, and we wish the owners the best of luck. And I bet you it's already on Instagram and the whole deal. So if any of you end up going out there, give us a holler. Because that's the thing is, we don't know how haunted it really is. 170 years old, you have to imagine it's haunted, but it didn't really give any specific reasons as to why, like the Cecil did.
Right. Yeah. I'm willing to find out.
There you go. With that said, let's get on to Bigfoot does not exist, using the scientific method to come to a conclusion. Essentially, what I read here, Mike, and obviously it's a lot of it was a little over my head, but essentially, by using Bigfoot as an example, you can use the scientific method essentially to figure out just about anything.
I mean, that's the idea. And I think like we live in a time where there's a lot of, let's just call it bad information out in the world. That's a generous way to put it. So I was kind of inspired to lay out the framework, you know, having taught statistics and scientific method for a lot of years, to lay out the framework for how we approach thought and problems and think through and analyze information that we might get so that we can better assess the world around us to, you know, to make better decisions and be more, I'm trying to be generous again, but, you know, not fall prey to to dangerous misinformation.
And what's your background? Because obviously we mentioned you're a filmmaker.
Yeah.
But this book is very detailed, and kudos to you, because I can only imagine how much time went into this. And the best part is, for anyone listening, it's not a long read. It's a 60-page book, and it is just loaded with information, and you can get a lot out of it. And you don't need a science background to really understand the whole premise of the book, which is cool. So what is your background, and how did this book essentially come about? Because you seem to have a lot of different talents.
Yeah, my training, my schooling was in electrical and computer engineering. And then I, in grad school, I did research work in auditory perception. So I got really interested in hearing. A lot of it related to a music background. So I played in bands for many, many years. And so I got really interested in how perception works and different, you know, things about what the physical reality is versus how we perceive it. And I think that's a lot about like what got me into, you know, scientific method in general, because we need to come up with some kind of objective methodology for kind of mapping out the physical world and how it relates to our experiences in the world. And so I had taught statistics. I was a professor for many years and taught statistics in like five or six different departments, and kind of came to a set of ideas that I found were that people really enjoyed learning about, even if they didn't have a math background. So, you know, a lot of times I would come to the first day of a stats class, and a lot of the students are like, oh, I hate math. This class is, it's going to be terrible. I don't want to learn any of this. And the goal was really to kind of shift that away from being about a fear of math into how we just think about problems and approach things, and how we kind of structure our day-to-day thinking, not even just like mathematical or statistical thinking. Because really it all kind of comes together. Like, you know, we talk about science or statistics, but really everything about how we process the world is related to these concepts. So I wanted to write the book based on my experience teaching to kind of lay out some of the fundamental tenets. And at least the first half, I think, is pretty basic and hopefully has enough analogies and relations with kind of intuitive real world things that people, even without any math or science background, can kind of understand the principles that are in it. That was my goal anyway. So.
Sure. And as far as, you know, the title is kind of jarring, you know, especially for anyone who likes the paranormal. We all have different ideas when it comes to Bigfoot specifically. Me personally, and you mentioned being a fan of cryptozoology, obviously Anastasia is as well. For me, Bigfoot is the one thing where I'm just like, you know what? No, not even getting into the statistics element of it and the numbers thing.
Yeah.
But there's been multiple shows, 9 or 10 seasons of Finding Bigfoot. And the most we ever get is like, oh, that thing ate meat. It's got to be out here. It's like, no. So what made you go with Bigfoot does not exist as the title, as opposed to, I mean, you really could have chosen a lot of things.
Yeah, it could have been anything. I mean, I always joke that that God is Dead was too controversial a title. So we got our first review of the book that was like complaining that it wasn't really about Bigfoot. But the truth is, it could be anything. It could be about literally anything. I did a podcast the other day about voter fraud. And, you know, cause I had framed this, you know, in talking about the book, I was like, this book could also be called Voter Fraud Does Not Exist, or, wow, you know, anything in real life. So you can frame it as anything, but Bigfoot was the thing that I like Bigfoot. I think Bigfoot is fun. And I think I tried to pick something that was not that controversial. I know, you know, as you note, it is controversial to say Bigfoot does not exist, but I tried to pick something that people could just appreciate as kind of humorous or entertaining. And most people are not that emotionally affected by that statement. And the point of the book is actually not that Bigfoot exists or doesn't exist. It's about developing a framework in order to assess something like whether Bigfoot exists. So anything I'm saying, like if I say Bigfoot does not exist, that's based on the framework and the information that we have. I would love, I even say in the book, I would love tomorrow to like find out that there's like a whole, you know, bunch of Bigfoot out in the woods. Like that would be awesome. I would be psyched about that. So it's not, you know, it's just really, I was hoping it was a fun kind of idea and it caught the eye.
It definitely does. I was like, yeah, that sounds so cool. And then the fact that it was like, I don't want to reframe. I was like, that was like a seriously important book, like, you know, with a cool title. You. I was like, oh, this is awesome, you know? But yeah, I think I have been recently obsessed with like Yeti and Bigfoot in general. So like, it really did tap into that, like, like, ooh, this looks like something. And then it was so much more deep and I loved that. So it was awesome.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for checking out.
Although now when you mention, I hope so, you know, tomorrow I wake up and a bunch of big feet do show. I can picture one of them showing up and just holding your book up and say, I read your book, dick.
I would be so happy for that to happen.
So for those who are listening and they're wondering, wait, how is he, you know, using the scientific method? Why is Bigfoot in the title? Essentially, by scientific definition, if you're using the scientific method, and tell me if I'm off base on this, but from what I remember, you have to start with the assumption that whatever you're studying does not exist, and you have to prove, the scientific method is designed to prove the assumption that it doesn't exist, or you're obviously trying to prove that it does exist, but it's important to have, and like in the paranormal world, we talk all the time, you know, Ashley was on Ghost Hunters and she's been investigating for 15 years. You have to be a responsible skeptic. but it's also very important to be objective in everything that you do.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, I think the fundamental idea, I think this is maybe the most fundamental tenet of all thought and logic, is that there's something called burden of proof. And the burden of proof is basically, you can't even have a conversation unless burden of proof is assigned to the person who is making a positive claim. So, for example, like the idea that Bigfoot exists, that's a positive claim. And so by the rules of logic, we're required to start with the negative claim. We're required to assume that Bigfoot does not exist. And the reason that we have to do this is because it's an unprovable, it's something that you cannot ever prove is true. So how would I prove, you know, if you think about this, how would I prove that Bigfoot doesn't exist? I would have to like simultaneously look in every spot all over the world and, you know, say, okay, Bigfoot's not here. So we know, but you know, maybe he's invisible at that moment or something. There's really no reasonable way to actually demonstrate that he does not exist. So, and this is true in all logic. I mean, Bigfoot is just an example. You know, you could apply this to literally anything. Anybody who's making the positive claim then has the burden of proof. And what you need then is you have to provide evidence. In the case of Bigfoot, you know, you might provide evidence like, and I give examples again in the book, like footprints or pieces of fur, or you might have a DNA sample, or you might have actually caught Bigfoot. And we might say that, you know, the type of evidence basically is going to give us a different amount of certainty about the existence of Bigfoot. So if we just see a big footprint, that's maybe like, that's cool, but that's not we're not really sure, right?
Just might be me walking around.
It could be, right? It could just be you with clown shoes or I don't know how big, are your feet very large?
They're
somewhat,
not small.
Somewhat large, yeah.
Okay. He wears moccasins.
Yeah. So it could, you know, so that's a relatively poor piece of evidence. If you have a Bigfoot, you know, in a cage, I would never want to cage Bigfoot, but let's say you were hanging out with Bigfoot. He let you take a blood sample. We determined it was a different genetic makeup. It was a different species than anything that we'd ever seen before. That would be really good evidence. You know, that would be really strong evidence. And then we would be able to reject that, what we call the null hypothesis or the negative claim, and say, we know now that Bigfoot does exist. Like, we have very strong evidence that Bigfoot does exist. So that's really the basis of the whole book. And I talk about the probabilities. I talk about the judicial system works this way. We're innocent until proven guilty, right? That's and we say, when we're looking for guilt, we say beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the same thing as a statistical idea. We're doing some kind of, you know, we don't know for sure that a person is guilty when they're ruled guilty. We just know that beyond reasonable doubt, that we have enough evidence to say that they're guilty. And when somebody is not guilty, we don't say that they're innocent in a trial, because we haven't proven that they're innocent. We just say they're not guilty because we don't have enough evidence to demonstrate that they are guilty. Just the same with Bigfoot. We start with the assumption Bigfoot does not exist. And when we have enough evidence, we can say, you know, guilty, Bigfoot does exist. If we don't have enough evidence, the only thing we can really say is, there is not sufficient evidence to say that Bigfoot exists.
So essentially the burden of proof is, no matter what claim you're making, maybe Anastasia says Bigfoot does exist and Ashley's like, Bigfoot doesn't exist. Whatever thing you're claiming, you are responsible for those results.
If it's a positive claim. So in other words, if it's a claim that there is something there, basically, then you need to provide that evidence. So if you just say, like, honestly, you know, if I'm going to claim, we start with the assumption that Bigfoot does not exist. So it's almost like not even a claim or an argument that we make. Yeah. It's not even something that we can argue for, really, in terms of science. It's something that we use as a starting point, and then somebody else has to, you know, provide the evidence to say that that claim is not true.
Right.
So it's complicated. I mean, it's unintuitive. And it frustrates people because they want both sides of that debate to be like on equal footing, kind of like both to provide evidence. But in fact, there's just not really, other than saying like, yeah, you know, you already pointed out, we've had 9 seasons of a show looking for Bigfoot. We've looked for years and years and nobody's found him. So in a sense, that's evidence, you know, because we tried really hard to look. But it's also not, you know, negative evidence isn't really evidence. It's just like we don't have any evidence.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I feel like when it comes down to it, it's always going to seem like we're not getting evidence, because with those TV shows and everything that we do, like, we're filming some weird shit where we're not investigating, you know? So it's kind of a weird situation where we would love to prove the afterlife to people, but at the same time, we don't get to. It sounds really shitty because we get filmed all the time, but there is points where you are investigating where, like, you are very specific about doing an investigation and you have this energy for it, and you get evidence, and then the rest of it where you don't get shit. So
right, and there's no, you know, there's no definitive, this is part of it too. It's like, we can debate, like, if we have a set, you know, we put a pile of evidence on the table, we can debate whether that evidence is sufficient or not to make the claim. Again, like with the Bigfoot, you know, you can say, for you, maybe those footprints, that's enough. Maybe that's enough. And for me, maybe it's not enough. You know, I say that I need more than that. And, like, so we can debate that. There's no right answer as to, like, what is sufficient evidence. Yeah. Even in like real hard science, we set, you know, when we talk about probabilities, what we typically do is we set a percentage criteria where we say, if we're 95% sure, or if we're 99% mathematically sure of something, then we make the claim that that is true. So, you know, in a way, we'd say if we could mathematically assess Bigfoot, right? We'd say if we're 95% sure that Bigfoot exists, that would be enough for science to say Bigfoot exists. But we're never know. We never know anything. That's really what it comes down to. It's all,
and that's probably science. That's, you never know anything.
We never know. But that's not, you know, I mean, and people talk about that as a weakness of it, but it's actually, in a lot of ways, it really is a strength of it, because it's adaptable to new information. It's something where we say, like, what do we have now? What's the best conclusion we make from that information?
Yeah.
And then we're totally open. So, you know, like, if today I say there's not evidence of Bigfoot, and then tomorrow, you know, Bigfoot shows up, you might say, like, oh, you were wrong, you know, Bigfoot was here. But I wasn't wrong. I used the information I had in the correct way to make what, you know, what I would call a correct conclusion. Mm-hmm. And that's a strength. Again, being able to adapt and not have a definitive answer ever is a strength of it.
And like you mentioned, for anyone to, the scientific method has been proven time and time again. And for anyone to say that a hunch or inference is is more believable than an actual statistical method and following the odds, well, that's just wishful thinking on their part. And look, we know plenty of people, we've all met Bigfoot hunters who are absolutely convinced. Hell, I went to the Bigfoot Museum, it was in North Carolina, actually, on a road trip this past fall. And, you know, there are footprints galore, you know, in the case. And right, we were right by the woods where they were just, I got Bigfoot hunters coming in all the time, and they're absolutely certain. But when it comes down to it, it's Occam's razor. It's like, yep. What's the most likely answer? The most likely answer is no, there's no Bigfoot, because yeah, we've seen a couple weird grainy videos. We've seen footprints, but by God, there's so many people searching for this damn thing, and we still don't have even a photo that can be proven.
Well, I think there's a difference between, like, wishfully believing something, or like wishfully thinking that I hope that this exists, and being able to prove it, right? So I think those are two very different things. I mean, there's a lot of things in the paranormal that I'm like, and cryptids, I'm like, that would be cool. I hope so. That's awesome. But I can't prove it.
Yeah. Well, so. I think that I want, you know, the I want to believe thing is a really interesting idea, because it doesn't imply that it's true necessarily, but it shows the enthusiasm. And I think there, you know, there's a value in imagination and in thought and in exploring things. I mean, there's a value in exploring things. And I think it's a balance of, you know, we don't want to become too unimaginative. And there are people like, so I, you know, I'm probably what would be called a skeptic, because I adhere pretty hard to the, you know, to this kind of methodology. And I would say, like, until I see evidence of it. But there are also people who are like, who want to just disregard evidence when there is evidence of things, you know, because they're like, no, I've already decided that this is right. This is wrong, and so I'm going to disregard all evidence. And I think that's, you know, that's just as bad or you know, just as dangerous an idea as well. So, you know, my hope is, you know, with writing the book and with talking about it, with, you know, with teaching courses in statistics, is to empower people to be able to evaluate evidence and think about, you know, the things that they observe, and to be able to assess, you know, make their own assessment. My job isn't to give you the answer. I'm not even telling you, I know the book is called Bigfoot Does Not Exist, but I'm not even really telling you that Bigfoot does not exist. I'm telling you that, you know, this is the set of tools and this is the framework by which we, according to the rules of logic and science and the basis of thought, this is the framework that we need to use. There's really no other framework we can use.
Well, I'm glad you just mentioned that, because to me, the scientific method, the one thing that it guarantees is if you follow it, it eliminates personal bias.
Yep.
You know, because the paranormal world, it's a lot of personal bias. So by putting in the title, Bigfoot Does Not Exist, and people read into it, you're proving the point, like, no, if you follow this method, whether or not you believe in Bigfoot, it's irrelevant. It will guide you on the right path as far as finding the most logical answer.
That's right. That's exactly the point. And again, I'm not trying to give people the answer. I'm trying to give people the tools to find the answer.
Which is really important. That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. I love
it. It can be applied to so much. So much.
Yeah. We won't talk about, but yes. Yeah.
We need more method. We need more method in the world. One of my favorite quotes in the book, you put a couple of really good quotes from people, and my favorite one was, the good thing about science is that it's true whether or not you believe in it. And of course, that's Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's always good for a great tweet.
Yeah. And, you know, not in all, in some scientific pursuits, not everybody agrees on the, you know, the interpretation, like I was saying, you know, of the results. And so that's great. I mean, that gives us opportunity to continue exploring and learning and gathering new evidence, you know, about whatever it is we're exploring, and then making new decisions. So
yeah,
that's,
yeah,
you know, debate
and new methods too. I mean, like, yep, you see this so much in, you know, I'm a true crime freak, and so, like, I've seen over the years what constituted as evidence and, you know, proof, now is not even, you can't even put, yeah, that in court. So, you know, it's very interesting. Science is adaptable as well, you,
yep,
know,
absolutely
grows.
And what's really cool about this book is if you read it, it makes you even more open-minded, because a lot of us, we have our certain opinions or our certain feelings about different things. And when you read the book, you're reminded of things like, oh yeah, there's a lot more that can be done than just how I feel about this. Like Ashley talks about it all the time when it comes to paranormal investigation, do the work. You know, we can all say, you're goddamn right, ghosts exist. And I will say that all the time because I believe they do. But, you know, she says, like, no, we need to go out and we need to prove that something does exist.
Yeah, there's an emotional aspect, especially into the paranormal. But if you're not doing the work to prove it in a scientific level and like an investigative level, it's not investigating.
Thank you, Anastasia.
Welcome. And I speak actually.
Right, she is right. I think that when it comes down to it, what it comes down to is specifically that what we deal with when it comes to paranormal investigating is we can't rely on our feelings and our empathy and whatever that aspect of it is. We do have to actually think about the scientific methods behind it. Do I absolutely get excited when my emotional aspects take a part of it? Yes. I get really excited when I have like an empathic moment and it takes a part of that investigation. Can I use that as evidence? No, absolutely not. And I think that's such a big thing that people kind of forget about is, yeah, like we have these really amazing moments where we get to experience something, but that's not evidence enough to use science or anything else otherwise. And we really have to focus on that part of it if we want to prove that what we are doing is scientific, and if we want to show people that what we are doing is serious.
Yeah.
It has to be based off of legitimate science and logic and mathematics and all of it. And sometimes these TV shows, including shows that I might have been on and blah, 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 we have to focus on that. And I really hope that going forward, that's something that we all do.
Simply put,
for sure,
science ain't got no room for emotion. That's pretty much.
Can I talk briefly about one other perceptual idea that I think might apply here? Is that okay?
Sure.
So you probably have heard that. I'm sure you've heard it before, but you know, the idea of apophenia, the idea that basically humans are designed. You know, we think of ourselves like we're looking out into the world objectively, like our eyes see objectively what's in the world, our ears hear objectively, but we're basically built as pattern detectors. We look for patterns, and we're tuned to the types of things that we experienced as we were developing. And they've done studies. They've done things like taking. I mean, these are horrible, horrible studies. So I love animals, but there were these horrible studies with cats, for example, where they put them in a room growing up. They were basically born and put in this room that only had horizontal lines on the wall and had no vertical lines at all. And the cats lost the ability to perceive, like once they were developed and let out in the world, they would like walk into poles and stuff. They had ability to see vertical patterns. They just never developed the ability to do it. And the reason I bring up that story is because we only are able to detect the things that we're looking for. And we tend to favor seeing those things even when they aren't there. And you can think of it like evolutionarily, like if you're, let's say you're walking through the woods and there's a bear hiding behind a tree, it's better for you to make the mistake and say like, oh, I see a bear when there isn't a bear, than it is for you to say, oh, I don't see a bear and there is one. Mm-hmm. You know, we're better off making false positives, what we would call false positives. And so as a result of our tuning to this kind of phenomenon where we're attuned to making false positive perceptual responses, we have this phenomenon called apophenia, where we have things like where we see faces in clouds, or we see, you know, if you see a stain on the wall or something, you see like a face in it or a pattern in it. We're always detecting things that we're familiar with, even when they aren't there. And that becomes a big part of how perception works. And part of why it's hard to trust our own perception in terms of some of these pursuits, you know, when we're trying to make actual measurements, when we're talking about feelings or, you know, ideas, we're so attuned to having these false positive perceptions that it's hard to differentiate those from like objective reality.
It's funny because when I started reading the book, I didn't know what to expect. And then after about 10 pages, I'm like, oh, this is brilliant. Like now I understand what he's going for here, you know? And so it's such a cool way of doing it. And you did it in a way that, like I said, it's not a long read. So you can take the time to really let your mind dig in a little bit, and you don't need a science background to thoroughly enjoy the knowledge that you get from it. So thank you for coming up with this idea, and thank you for joining us on the show. And if people do want to find the book, what's the best way for them to get it?
It's basically on Amazon as an ebook right now, and there will be a physical copy at some point once I'll probably do another revision of it and add a few things. I've been kind of like, you know, it's released and I kind of get feedback from people and they're like, oh, I'd like to see this other concept included in it or this other, you know, this other element. And I'm trying to keep it as concise as possible, like you say, because I want people to be able to read it in something like an hour or an hour and a half. But there are a few more things I want to add before it goes into physical print. So
awesome. And to find you on social media at Michael J. Epstein on everything, right?
Everything. Yeah. All over
the
place.
And you have a podcast, as well, right? How can people find
we
that?
We do, yeah. So my wife and I have a production company called Launch Over, and so our podcast is called Launch Over Podcast, and it's kind of our just sort of our newsletter about like what we're making, what we're watching. It's kind of like you get to hang out with us because we don't see anybody for the past year. We haven't really seen anybody, so we're like, this is our way of sort of hanging out with our friends, talking about movies.
Amazing.
There you go. Awesome. At Michael J. Epstein, make sure you find him, pick up the book as well, or just hit us up on social media. We're going to be posting videos from this show as well as the episode so you can enjoy it. Ashley Trobe, where can people find you?
Ashley Trobe on everything.
Anastasia.
You can find me at Anastasia W on Twitter, at Anastasia Wash on Instagram, and Anastasia TV on YouTube. I think that's it.
There you go. I am at Jay Quasto on the socials. And of course, we are at Haunts and Hops. Make sure you use the code HAUNTS10 for Tavor. Get the best craft beer from across the country delivered right to your door at a very fair price. And of course, if you have a paranormal experience that you want to describe to us, call us, leave us a voicemail, 818-660-6191. That's 818-660-6191. Call us, leave us a message. We'll play it on the show. And with that said, it's time to say goodbye for this week.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, bye. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed it, tell a couple of friends and please rate and review the show on whatever platform you're listening on, especially if it's iTunes and Apple Podcasts. We appreciate you.